I'm Neil Brower. I'm a graduate student at UC Davis, and my advisors are Toby O'Gene and Randy Dahlgren, and we're working on a project in the San Joaquin Valley, and we're looking at temporal variability in water quality of agricultural tailwaters in ditch systems pretty similar to the ones that were discussed in the last talk. And we're going to relate this to the implications that it has on monitoring strategies in terms of sample number and sampling frequency. We'll start this talk with a brief history lesson. So in 1972, the Clean Water Act was enacted. This regulated point source polluters such as industry and factories, but there was an exemption written in this for agricultural operations, just because the economic implications would have been too big, and also it's just a mammoth task to try to regulate all these non-point source polluters. But in this was written an exemption, and in 2002, this waiver for agricultural operations expired, and at that point, it was up to the states to decide how they wanted to regulate non-point source pollution originating from agriculture on their own. In 2003, California adopted what they call the Conditional Waivers Program, and what this means basically is that farmers are responsible for pretty much every drop of water that leaves their land, and that they, through a monitoring program, need to be able to demonstrate to the state that their water won't impede the quality of California's surface waters in relation to TMDL limits. Currently, this program mandates that farmers take at least one sample per month during the irrigation season and two storm events. We're just focusing on the irrigation season in California. In the Central Valley, it pretty much doesn't rain between about the beginning of May through the end of September. So the time when most of the crops are summer crops are growing, all of the water and runoff is strictly due to irrigation water. So on to our study. We want to quantify the variability of certain water quality constituents, a lot of the ones that Jeff talked about. We want to evaluate sort of the merits of different sampling strategies, taking grab samples or looking at composite samples where we take multiple samples and basically put it into one big bottle and just analyze that conglomeration of the different samples. We want to explore the possibilities of using proxies of one constituent for another, like maybe EC tracks with total nitrogen or turbidity tracks with total phosphorus, and some easy to measure constituents like EC or turbidity could be helpful in terms of monitoring. We also want to look at the effect that watershed size has on constituent variability. The thought behind this is that smaller watersheds are going to have sort of a smaller number of farms contributing. And you're going to, because of this, you're going to have less of an averaging effect in these main drainage dishes. So variability is probably going to be higher in these smaller watersheds. And ultimately, we want to sort of determine the number of samples that are necessary to meet given accuracy and confidence standards. So our sampling sites here, we've got three sites. This map here shows the Central Valley of California, or the San Joaquin Valley from the southeast corner here, flowing to the northwest corner, is the San Joaquin River. Those three red dots indicate our sampling sites. The site that we call Site 1 has the smallest drainage area of all of them. It gathers water from approximately 800 acres. Site 2 has a drainage area of about 4,000 acres or so. And Site 3, we just picked this up last year, and we haven't had a chance to do a bunch of sort of the background research on it, but it's by far the largest drainage area of all of our sites and is greater than 4,000 acres. Because these are such huge areas, there's a variety of crops in all of the drainages, but sort of typical summer cropping patterns are tomatoes, melons, beans, grapes, and alfalfa, and also some nuts, too. So the first year, we sort of wanted to take an intensive look at our smallest watershed to figure out how we wanted to monitor all of these watersheds, because so little research has been done in terms of variability. So we picked the smallest watershed, assuming that it would have the highest variability, and we collected discrete samples at 6-hour intervals. We looked at total nitrogen, total phosphorus, turbidity, and EC. We chose these constituents because they're pretty conservative over time, so we don't need to worry about refrigeration because it just wouldn't have been practical at the rate that we were sampling. So it added up to a lot of samples, a total of 630, which at this point I'll thank Jiayu Deng, who's sitting back there, who helped us analyze all of these samples. Couldn't have done it without him. And then we also took weekly grab samples and analyzed for a larger suite of constituents, the same four that I listed above, as well as nitrate nitrogen, ammonium nitrogen, phosphate, and then total suspended solids. These show time series plots from this first year. Don't need to pay too much attention to this, but sort of the take-home message from this is that variability is pretty high. Why don't we look at the graph of total nitrogen for a minute, which is the second one down from the top there. On the y-axis, we have a range of milligrams per liter from 0 to 80 ppm, and you can see that there's a pretty big spread of data points. So definitely pretty high variability, but relating this back to the big question of how many samples do we need, we needed to take a different approach, and we decided to just use the sort of simple concept of a 95% confidence interval about the mean. We sort of said, okay, how many samples do you need to take throughout a given irrigation season to be within a given percentage of this mean value? So what we did here, if you look, this middle line represents the seasonal mean value from these 630 samples for total nitrogen. And we said, okay, well, how many samples would you need to take to be within 20% of your total mean? And so if you look, this line across here, that blue line drawn across there, where it intersects this 95% confidence interval, if you look at the line that drops down to the x-axis there, it's right around 75 samples or so. And you can use the same method for any given accuracy standard. So we sort of said, okay, well, another arbitrary one we could choose would be 50%. And you can see a pretty drastic reduction in sample numbers if you're willing to compromise your accuracy. This next table shows sort of a summary of these calculations that we made at the two different accuracy levels. Our worst case scenario was turbidity, and I should mention that these are listed in sample number per month, that the season represents 5 months, so we just divided those numbers for seasonal average by five. So turbidity would take 67 samples per month to be 20%, within 20% of that seasonal mean value, and 11 samples if you're willing to go back to a 50% accuracy level. Our best case scenario was electrical conductivity, which are four samples and one samples per month respectively, and total nitrogen and total phosphorus were both pretty high, with phosphorus especially being high. We also looked at, if you look to the right of those first numbers that I showed there, sample number if we use daily composite samples, where if we were to take four of these samples that we took at 6 hour intervals and dump them into one bottle and just look at sort of the average of those four samples, we see a pretty drastic reduction in sample number. Total nitrogen was our best case, where sample number was reduced by 51% without reducing your accuracy standards at all. So that's pretty encouraging, looking at the possibility of using composite sampling as a technique to reduce sample number, to get your sample number down to a more manageable size. So we decided for the next season, which was the 2007 season, to heed our own advice, and we used daily composite samples rather than discrete samples. Here I'll just follow this example of using total nitrogen. These are time series plots from our three watersheds for total nitrogen. On the y-axis, they're all the same scale, 0 to 30 ppm. Watershed 1, which is our smallest watershed, you can see there's just a huge spread of data points, really variable. Watershed 2, which was the mid-sized watershed, is actually the most stable of all of them. And Watershed 3 is somewhere in between, but certainly more stable than Watershed 1. This next slide shows the results of all of the different constituents here. Once again, we see that turbidity is pretty variable at all the sites, but more importantly, we see in following this example of total nitrogen that this idea of watershed size having an effect on variability is definitely true. In watershed 1, we'd need to take 8 daily composite samples per month to be within 20% of our seasonal mean average. Watershed 2, we'd only need 2 samples per month. And watershed 3, we'd only need 4 samples per month. And it's also encouraging that if we go back, are willing to scale back our accuracy standards a little bit at the 50% level, these are beginning to get into manageable numbers of samples. So I told you I'd talk about proxies. the two that we decided that I'm showing here are ones that we found that there is at least a potential to have them be helpful in terms of monitoring. So does EC, can EC stand in for nitrate, or can turbidity stand in for total phosphorus? Well, in watershed one, which is the graph in the upper left-hand corner, this is showing electrical conductivity versus nitrogen, and this is calculated from those weekly grab samples that I talked about. We get a decent correlation with an R-squared of about 0.47. The other two watersheds showed virtually no correlation at all. So in terms of a wide-scale monitoring plan, it probably can't apply to more than individual watersheds that intensive studies have been completed on. Turbidity for total phosphorus looks maybe a little bit more promising. Watershed 1 didn't show much of a correlation. I should also mention at this point that there's pretty significant evidence that PAM is used a lot, which keeps a lot of sediment on the fields, and a lot of the phosphorus that's coming in is sediment bound. In these other watersheds, we don't see as much. We see higher turbidity values, so we don't think as much PAM is used, and a lot of the sediment that comes in, or phosphorus that comes in, is bound to sediments. So for watershed 2 and 3, we both have R-squareds above 50%. So there's definitely the potential that it could at least help with monitoring. So the overall conclusions is that, first of all, water quality is really highly variable in these systems, especially in smaller watersheds, like this 800-acre watershed we looked at. Variability was very high. Composite sampling really reduces sample number without compromising accuracy at all, so using equipment like ISCO autosamplers and things like that are definitely a great monitoring tool. Proxies have the potential to be helpful, but really only on a case-by-case basis. Intensive studies like the ones we've completed here would need to be done on individual watersheds before this could be considered for any statewide monitoring scheme. Which brings me to my last point, which is that an effective monitoring plan really needs to be adapted to individual watersheds, because watershed size and, I'm sure, crop type has a lot to do with this. So in relation to California's Ag Waivers Program that I talked about, this tack of only taking one sample per month and just saying that all farmers and watersheds need to use one sample per month just really doesn't address variability in these systems at all. That's it. Thank you.